Welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to episode 69 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. Well, folks, if you know me at all by now, you probably know that I listen to a lot of podcasts while I commute back and forth to work on the wonderful transit system that we have here in Toronto, the subways, the streetcars, and what have you. And imagine my surprise, my kinship, when I found a website out there that I thought was something of the same. I thought it was a person who had elite taste and used public transportation. Well, unbeknownst to me, it was actually a reference to a film that I haven't seen. So perhaps before we get too far into the show, our guest will actually point out the error of my ways. But indeed, today we do have the proprietor of the Public Transportation Snob, a site you can find at ptsnob.com. We are across the wire to St. Louis, Missouri, home of Chuck Berry, Stan Musial, and John Hamm. Please welcome Dan Heaton to the show. How are you, sir?
I am very well, and I will clarify that I actually do ride the train to work most days in St. Louis.
But you have to explain, because your site name is a reference to something, right?
Yeah, no, it's kind of both. It's the movie is Metropolitan, which is a Whit Stillman movie that I love. And so I kind of, when I was coming up with the name for the site, I thought, I was trying to think, I don't really want to just call it, you know, hey, Dan likes movies or something like that. I was like, I want to think of something different. And I had happened to just watch that movie. And I also ride the train a lot. So I thought, you know, it kind of fits. You know, okay. I am a bit of a public transportation snob, but I wouldn't say that I'm particularly crazy in that regard. I do drive a car and things. So, you know, in St. Louis, it's kind of a requirement. But I also just thought it was kind of a neat reference to one of my favorite directors.
I like it. I like it a lot, sir. And now I think I'm going to have to track down that film and give it a watch. If you want to learn more about the details of the guest and recording of episode 69, do check out the Twitter series I call Mike and the Mechanics. You'll find those if you follow my Twitter feed today being Monday, October 8th, or by searching #MATM69. Episode 69 is the Thanksgiving episode. We will be discussing Looper. We'll be finding out what people are thankful for and turn the record over to Play the Other Side. Before any of that, we need to learn more about Dan. This is Know Your Enemy. Dan, you've heard many of these before. You have an idea of how this goes, and I understand you've been working feverishly to come up with some enlightening answers for this section.
Definitely. I've been working on it for many, many hours. It's going to blow your mind.
Or at least many minutes, right?
Definitely.
Okay.
A few seconds.
Let's start at the beginning. What is the first film you can remember seeing in a theater?
You know, I'm not 100% sure because there were a few movies around the same time, but I am pretty certain it is The Empire Strikes Back.
Very nice.
Yeah, because I was born in 1976, and I know that Empire Strikes Back came out in 1980, and I remember seeing it in the drive-thru, and I'm pretty sure it's the first movie I saw. I mean, I was pretty young. I had not seen Star Wars, you know, at the time. I'm sure it was more my parents wanted to see it and brought me along, but I have a pretty distinct memory of especially like the Hoth scenes and some of that stuff and being a kid, because, you know, drive-thrus were a lot more common back in the early 80s than they are now. So
yeah,
drive-in.
I was gonna say, did you get like a side of fries with your movie?
We went to the drive-thru and there was a movie playing. It was crazy. Now, private movie theaters nearby, there was a few that I can remember that we used to go to a lot as a kid. So yeah, it was a great time to be a kid, though. I mean, just there were so many good movies that I saw at that time period.
Now, did your parents have like a great big car? Did they do the kind of thing where they pulled it in backwards and like drop down the tailgate or anything like that? You weren't sitting in like the back of a Volkswagen or anything, were you?
No, I mean, obviously, being that the cars probably were from the 70s, I do have some memories because I'm the youngest of three. So five of us would cram into some sort of large Mercury or Lincoln or something. But yeah, I have some nice memories of that, seeing that in E.T. and a few other movies around that time. So
that's very cool. Of course, you know, it's kind of funny, just given the age bracket of a lot of the guests that I brought on the show, Star Wars and Empire Strike Back have come up a few times on this show. It's it's one of those ones that, like, even if, you know, for all we know, like, your parents took you to one or two more before that, but it's, I think it's one of those ones that sticks out in your brain, you know, like those kinds of epic event movies, those are the ones that really kind of grab in there and stay with you.
I think so, because I was thinking back to what movies I saw around that time, and the ones that stick in my mind are like Star Trek II and Return of the Jedi and like Empire Strikes Back. So there are all these kind of movies that still now people watch.
Conversely, what is one of the last films you watched?
Well, the last movie I watched before the stuff for this podcast was it was for like the monthly Blind Spot series that I've been doing, and a lot of bloggers I know yourself am doing, and it was Barry Lyndon.
Oh, which, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and it was – I mean, I've seen most of Kubrick's movies. I haven't seen – actually, I've seen all but Lolita and a few of the really early ones that people don't really talk about much. So this was one of the big ones that I hadn't seen, and I liked it. I think it's visually stunning. I mean, people overuse the phrase, oh, that film looks like a painting, but this one looks like a painting. And I don't know. I mean, I will say that – I mean, it's very long. And I don't have a problem with long movies, but there were points when I wouldn't say I would throw it at the top of my list as far as Kubrick. I think it's worth seeing for anyone who's a film fan, though I do feel like there's some great scenes, but the whole movie is just kind of good.
I think for me, for Kubrick, and the last 2 years especially, 3 years tops, have been a real turnaround for me with Kubrick. For a long time, I wasn't really crazy about him. It's safe to say I didn't get him. And then suddenly things started kind of clicking, and he's become one of my very favorite directors. But for all of his work, that is, if it's not the one I like the least, it's one of the ones I like the least. Which is not to say that it's not good. It's handsome. It is really, really pretty. But it's I don't know why I didn't really connect with that. I don't tend to gravitate towards like stories of decadence, and that is kind of what the tale of Barry Lyndon is, right? It's about a guy who's trying to live the high life even though he's drowning in debts and basically just living off his name, and not even his name, isn't it?
It's like, no, yeah, he becomes Barry Lyndon, yeah, when he marries. It's actually he's Redmond Barry, who's pretty much a nobody. But yeah, I think Kubrick has a reputation for kind of being a cold filmmaker in a sense. And this movie is, I mean, one of those movies where I feel like I admire it and I say, wow, this is a really well-done movie. But part of it is you just don't really connect with the lead character. And I think that's sort of by design. He's almost kind of like Leonardo DiCaprio in Catch Me If You Can, or somebody who just becomes what he can to move forward. He doesn't really seem to have his own personality.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So it's, in a sense, it's like, especially because it's basically set up in two parts. And the second part, basically every bad thing you can think of happens. Yeah. I mean, without spoiling too much, it's melodrama. I mean, it's a sad movie, but it's not as impactful because, in a sense, for me at least, I'm not as drawn into Barry or to Barry Lyndon's, to his story. And I don't know, that could be Ryan O'Neill too, who I think is good, but I would not say is somebody who's a real charismatic actor.
Yeah. Now, the other thing I think of is that where Kubrick is concerned, I had to watch every single one of his, almost every single one of his movies, at least more than once, to really soak him in and start to pick up on all sorts of things. And Barry Lyndon is, of all of his films, the only one I've only seen one time. So it could be that as well, that if I watched it once or twice more, there might be a little bit more that I gravitate towards. But right now, it's, I just kind of put it over there as, yeah, watch it if you just want to watch his whole works. But glad you dug it. What is one of the worst films you have ever seen, sir?
Wow, there are so many choices for this one. And I can't say this is the worst because it just kind of has stuck with me. And the movie is called Gentlemen Broncos. And okay, it's from 2009. It's by the director Jared Hess, who did Napoleon Dynamite.
Yes.
And the thing is, when I saw Napoleon Dynamite originally, I really enjoyed it. I was kind of like, wow, this is a director we need to watch. And I did watch that again, and it was only okay. I still liked it, but not as much. But you know how quirkiness is a tricky thing? Like, you think
it's a fine line.
Yeah, like Wes Anderson. I mean, I love Wes Anderson. Moonrise Kingdom is my favorite movie I've seen this year. This movie is on the other side of quirkiness. It's painfully quirky. And I only really watched it because also Jermaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords is in it as one of the main parts. But it was painful. Like, it was one where you're watching it at home, it's an hour and a half, and it was a struggle. So it's one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
Oh, brother. There's little elements of that that sound like it might be interesting, but at the same time, there's so many of these little indie films that just seem like a complete mess. Like, you can see what the people involved were trying to do, but if it doesn't click, if it doesn't have that little thing that helps to elevate it, it just becomes kind of flat, and you end up feeling like you wasted your time.
Yeah, and I think this is kind of almost a symbol for that kind of movie. Mm-hmm. Where, I mean, I've heard people that like it that say, you know, it's really funny and it's really clever, because the plot itself sounds fairly, like, interesting, like a cute indie film, but it did not work for me.
That's unfortunate. Well, speaking of your blind spots, what is a classic or essential film that you have not seen, sir?
Wow, there are so many, especially when you get into foreign films, where I've tried to catch up. But one that I picked is Kurosawa movie, Yojimbo, is one I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
Because I've seen a decent amount of Kurosawa films, but this one, I mean, the fact is I've seen, you know, a lot of movies have taken kind of the similar plot, where the guy goes and there's two different warring factions and he gets them to basically fight each other. Like, you know, there's Last Man Standing, there's, you know, Fistful of Dollars, but I've never seen this one. And I feel like this is kind of the origins of that plot. And it's always comes up on the list that I'll see of, like, you know, it's kind of those classics you need to see. And it's kind of an example of just the type of movie that I really need to sit down and go through.
Yeah, it is the origin of Fistful of Dollars. I think, like, if I got my facts straight, and I think I do, it is the one that is based on. Somewhere, if he still listens to this show, Ryan Helms is, like, beating his brain in, because I know he loves to sell people on Yojimbo. I was lucky enough, the first time I saw that, actually, which would have been maybe 3 years ago now, 4 years ago, I think. I caught it at a little rep screening here. One of our little art house theaters played it as a double feature with Hidden Fortress. So it was kind of cool because I could see the origin film for Fistful of Dollars and then followed that with one of the origin films for Star Wars.
Yeah, and I have seen that movie, and that's really interesting to watch.
Yeah, I will tell you this much. It holds up very, very well, as most of his films do, and it's a breezy watch. Like, some of his films can be kind of epic. Like High and Low is like 2.5 hours, and Seven Samurai I think is like 3. Ron is kind of long as well. This one's kind of breezy. If it's not 90 minutes, I think I might be short selling it there. It's 2 hours, and it moves. So now, did you put that on your blind spots for this year? Are you going to see that before this year's out?
I have it for this year. I thought about including one of those, but I was like, I'm going to look further ahead, because those I am going to watch. It's like set in stone. Where this one, I'm like, maybe next year I'll put it on there.
Yeah.
What's weird is that I've seen most of his long movies. Like, I've seen Ron, and I've seen High and Low. And, you know, so I've watched all the ones that you would think would be something that would hold you up. Or, you know, I saw Dreams recently that isn't as long, but it's pretty slow moving.
Yeah.
But for some reason, this one always I think I've even had it in my DVR at times, and then we moved to somewhere else and I lost it. So, it's gonna happen soon. I can feel it.
Well, you're in for good things, I'll tell you that much, as I'm sure you probably well know. And last but not least, what is a film that for any reason you wish you had a hand in making?
It's a tricky question. So I decided to go with Casino Royale, because. Okay. Well, here's the thing. I grew up watching a lot of James Bond movies. My parents were pretty strict about, you know, kids, you're not watching R-rated movies. So, but they were fine with the Bond films. So, you know, being fairly young, those movies have, you know, action and more things. So we watched a lot of those. And I also read a lot of the books. So the reason I picked it is just, I'm trying to think of, I mean, Casino Royale, before it came out, was always kind of the book that, you know, it had never been made, but it was kind of the great white whale or something. It's like the first one. It's a kind of story. And to be able to make an origin story for James Bond and to make that story and to actually do it well with, like, as a modern movie, I just think being involved with that would have been really cool.
Yeah, that was the funny thing was that kind of came – I don't want to say it came after a low point for James Bond because
– It did.
Well, it did. Like, okay. I had fun with Die Another Day. I wouldn't say it's a great Bond. I wouldn't even necessarily say it's a good Bond. But I enjoyed it. I didn't kind of walk away with the distaste in my mouth that I had with The World Is Not Enough, for instance. Or I'm not a fan of the Timothy Dalton ones. So I was like, oh, okay, it's all right. And when they were, you know, they said, okay, we're done with Pierce Brosnan. We're going to move on to somebody else. So to kind of hit the restart button – first of all, well on them because, you know, we didn't realize that we'd actually never gone back to the beginning. Well, you know, I'm sure you did, of course, as most like hardcore Bond fans. But like just to the kind of casual observer, it was like we've never started at page one. So to do that was kind of a cool thing. And not only to do that, but then to execute, because Lord knows that since then, and that was the same year as Batman Begins, there's been a lot of attempts at origin stories, and most of them aren't working. So to say, you know, I want to have a hand in one of the best origin stories out there, no, I can totally buy that. Lord knows I wish I'd had a hand in that film. So good call. I can tell you that nobody has ever picked that before. I've heard, you know, people have picked Star Wars. People have picked Lord of the Rings. Nobody has picked any James Bond film, let alone Casino Royale. And you have chosen it for good reason, sir. So well done. Your time spent mulling over the five questions has been time well spent. That's for sure.
Well, that's good to hear. That was a tricky one for me. You know, that was the toughest one for sure.
Wait till I get you back on the show and you got to do the next round of questions.
Those sound harder.
They are harder. I'm just happy I never have to answer them. Well, there we go. That's Dan and his backstory as a film goer and a film lover. But it's time to learn more about you fine folks. It's your chance to come talk to me right after this. Today, that this episode goes up, October 8th, is Thanksgiving here in Canada. If you're an American listener, we celebrate it ahead of you fine folks. If you live somewhere else in the world, you might not know what Thanksgiving is all about. Basically, family and friends get together, we eat, and we're supposed to give thanks for the good things that have happened in the last calendar year. So I put it to my listeners, as cinephiles, as moviegoers, as film lovers, what were some things that people are thankful for this year? And I got a lot of varied answers. Nick Huth, who listens, she writes, being Norma Jean and is in Dubai, said the cinema related thing I am most thankful for this year is finally enrolling in a college that has film studies. Sitting in my first film studies class might have been the happiest moment of my year so far, even though our facilities for that are just adequate at best. Because for the first time in my life, I felt that I am learning something I love, and not just because I'm smart and I'm bound to get good grades in it. I love showing off in my film knowledge there. I love having disruptive arguments about how Birth of a Nation sucks, and so on. For that, she says, I am very thankful. Rachel Thoreau from Real Insight said, I am happy that after 3+ years of eager waiting, I am finally able to take my daughter to the movies. Only 4 screenings so far. Finding Nemo was happening this weekend. And though they weren't all winners, for better or worse, it's been a wonderful addition to my movie-going experience, as I'm actually watching her grow with each outing. Can't remember a time before this past June that I actually looked forward to animated features. Dan, you've got kids, right?
I do. My daughter is 3.5.
And have you got to that point yet?
You know, she's gone to a few movies. She's definitely on the very energetic side of kids. So, but my wife took her to see The Muppets, and she loved it. We have it at home, and she's watched it many, many, many times.
Well, that's great. Because, so, you know, the funny thing about The Muppets is actually I remember when we were talking about it thinking – kids might not go for it just because, first of all, it's kind of a melancholy movie in places. Mm-hmm. And second of all, kids aren't always into Muppets anymore. That's good to know. That actually kind of encourages me a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, she knew them a little bit before the movie, but that soundtrack, she has listened to that soundtrack 200 times.
There is nothing wrong with that.
No, not at all. It's much better than some other options she could be picking to love, so I'm sure.
Well said. Jessica from the Velvet Cafe in Sweden says she's grateful that her local film club is still hanging on, showing all sorts of odd movies every week on a big screen at a low cost. It's a privilege to have something like that where you live. I can even have a say in what it shows. I'm equally thankful for being part of the movie blog sphere, which is as much of an outlet for my own thoughts and creativity as a source of inspiration for what to watch next. Andrew Robinson, my friend from Jamaica, now in Trinidad, said, I guess the most obvious answer to the thankful question has to be getting to go to TIFF and meet all you Canadian guys and gals over that 10-day span. Andrew, you are greatly missed, I can tell you, and we are equally thankful that you were able to make it up here. On Twitter, this was an interesting answer. On Twitter, James Blake Ewing, who is at CinemaSites, said that he's thankful for a Heaven's Gate Blu-ray release from Criterion. I've actually never seen Heaven's Gate. I only know it by notoriety. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I haven't seen it either. And I say, wow, like I'm such an expert on Heaven's Gate. But I haven't even seen The Deer Hunters, so I have a big blind spot about...
Well, they're kind of apples and oranges. Like, I know Heaven's Gate has its fans and has its defenders, but it is widely seen as one giant mess. Now, James claims that it's fantastic. I haven't seen it. Like, I almost want to see it, like, almost on a dare, just to kind of see what all the fracas is about. But James is happy that it's coming out on Blu-ray and that Criterion has it, so... good on you, James. My friend Simon from London, he's on Twitter as @ScreenInsight, is thankful for Chris Nolan delivering in every way he hoped. It's kind of a – I think that's a little bit in the minority. I know a lot of people actually were a little bit dissatisfied with The Dark Knight Rises. I am not one of them. I was quite happy. Were you in the yay or the nay on that?
You know, I enjoyed it a lot. I'd say if you go out – it's like a 4 out of 5-star movie.
Okay.
I really tried to go in without huge expectations because I thought if I go in and think this is going to be better than Dark Knight or even Batman Begins, which I love more than a lot of people, I'm going to be disappointed. So I really think given all the expectations, I mean, yes, there's some flaws in the plot and there are some characters that kind of go in directions that don't work as for me as much, but I enjoyed it overall. I think given all the expectations, he delivered.
Yep. Where it leaves me is I'm quite curious to see where he'll go next. So I think it's good to see that he was able to close out his trilogy his way and that he'll have some good energy going forward. Our friend Sam Fragoso, who tweets @SamFragoso, said he is thankful for the vibrant film community, podcasts like the Matinee Cast, thank you, Sam, and for Woody Allen. Well, Sam, hold on to that thought because I have a hunch that's coming back. Sean Kelly, who tweets @SK on movies, is thankful that he lives in a city that has many movie-going options and alternatives for the increasingly cringeworthy multiplexes. Sean, of course, lives in my hometown of Toronto. Speaking of my hometown of Toronto, Gabby D, she tweets @GabAndDad, is thankful for fellow moviegoers letting a mom bring her baby along. Now, I didn't actually dig in and find out if she went to, like, Movies for Mommies or if she actually like carted out her newborn to a matinee or anything. I guess I should have followed that up, but oh well. On Facebook, a few more answers before we move on. Jess Rogers also, like Andrew Robinson, was thankful that she got to attend TIFF. She said she's so thankful she might even rank it for American Thanksgiving, not just Canadian Thanksgiving. Jess, again, for your brief time that you got to come up here, you were well liked by all, and you're missed, of course. My friend Beth said, it might sound silly and hyper nerdy, but I'm really glad that Joss Whedon is finally getting the mainstream credit he deserves. With Cabin in the Woods, Avengers, and, in her opinion, Much Ado About Nothing, it's really been his year. Dan, you have a thought?
Oh, yeah. I was just going to second that.
Because, oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of Joss Whedon, and I wouldn't say it's since the beginnings of Buffy, but I kind of grabbed on at Firefly, and this year's for Joss Whedon fans has been just tops, you know, and I think it's only going to continue, especially with Avengers 2 and Much Ado About Nothing.
I'm something of a peripheral fan. You know, my friends and my wife are bigger fans than I am, admittedly, but I've just been around so much of his work for the last, well, I don't know, like 6 or 7 years now that it's kind of hard not to be. I said this during the film festival, and I still hold this sentiment true. I kind of wish that his fans would tone it down just a little bit. You know, Whedon is wonderful. Whedon is not God. And I can already see it happening. I promise you right this moment that we will get to January. We will get to the morning that the Oscar nominees are announced. Joss Whedon's name will not be named for Best Director, and there will be a huge outcry. So I am thankful for Joss Whedon. I am thankful that he you know, he was able to do something with a large budget, large profile that worked in every single way. And I hope that's my hope is that he's able to use this as currency going forward, because Lord knows he deserves it. My friend Susie Maynard, who is on the Mind Reels podcast with my friend Tim Rideout, she's thankful that she's closer to being able to see Dead Before Dawn 3D and Sex After Kids than she was this time last year. These are a pair of Canadian films that she and Tim at the Mind Reels have been very closely watching the production of. They know a lot of the actors who were involved and some of the director and writers, I believe. And they've become quite close to these productions, so they're coming close to release. And Susie's thankful that they're going to finally see the light of day. Sebastian Gutierrez is thankful that Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Jogo, is finally getting his big coming out party, thanks to roles like Looper and, of course, The Dark Knight Rises. Sebastian and our friend Tom Clift actually today went to check out Looper in New York City. They had a little meetup and went to take in a flick. So, yeah, Sebastian's a big fan, always has been, and I'm sure he's happy to see that Jogo is getting his moment in the sun. Last but not least, Stevie Taylor in New Zealand says, I know it's kind of dumb, but the fact that I got to see The Dark Knight Rises, and also that I got to see most of Jessica Chastain's films, and that she is awesome. So there we go. We got a lot of varied answers. Some people liking Community, some people liking specific titles and specific actors. And, you know, it's a great time to be a movie fan. I think we're getting to see a lot of various things and access to a lot of things as well. Like, I know I always trumpet the city I live in and the options that I have. But the one thing I've never really talked about, because it's not just something I don't really pursue, is material is becoming more and more available thanks to things like on demand and shorter release windows to get stuff on Blu-ray and that kind of thing.
Definitely. And I live in St. Louis, which is nowhere near the, you know, film community as Toronto, but there are still more things than I can possibly see. There's local college film series, there's classics being shown on the big screen. And then, like you mentioned, things on demand, and there's just too many things that I could possibly watch, which at times can feel like overload, but yeah. It's an awesome time compared to even how it was 10 years ago. It's completely different.
That's it. That's it. So I think that seems to be the overwhelming thing that we're all thankful for, is the bounty that we have ahead of us. So thanks everybody for writing in. If you are Canadian and you're celebrating Thanksgiving, I hope it's a good one. To my American friends, I'm sure I'll wish you the happy Thanksgiving in November. But there we go. It's like you were all here gathered around my table. Thank you very much for that. For the next episode, what I would like to know, we had a discussion on the In Between Days episode about scary movies. And of course, we're in October where horror movies are abounding. And what I want to know is, what's a movie or a few movies that genuinely scared you? Either you were just really freaked out while watching them, or you had nightmares later, or for all I know, you can't finish watching them. I would like to know what movies actually freaked you out. Let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I am matinee_CA, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. You can also, of course, leave a comment in the post on the blog. The new slang is coming up. We will be talking about Looper, and I should just give a disclaimer right now. Ordinarily, we try to stay spoiler-free when it comes to our feature topic. However, with Looper, I really feel that to discuss it and not discuss it as a whole is a bit of a disservice. So this will be a rather spoiler-laden conversation, so consider yourself forewarned. The new slang is coming up, and the new slang is Looper.
I had my dream, I held your hand on that broad avenue. We crossed the road and never spoke to another as we flew. We left your man alone and drag, laughing there at us. Romantic bust, a blunder turned, explosive blunderbuss.
Looper is written and directed by Rian Johnson. It stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Bruce Willis, and Emily Blunt. And it is about a basically a hitman. They are called loopers. They show up at a particular spot, and somebody is sent back in time that they execute, no questions asked. However, our looper, whose name is Joe, that's Joseph Gordon-Levitt, one day he goes to take a man out, and it is himself. This is not as strange as it would sound, certainly not as strange as the trailers would have you believe, because the hitch to the job is that you have to eventually close your loop, which means you have to kill yourself to tie off any loose ends. Unfortunately, when Joe goes to close his loop, his older self has other ideas. Dan, what did you think of Rian Johnson's Looper?
I am a big fan of Looper. I think it's a really intriguing movie. It's one of those movies that I think I came out of it saying, wow, that was really interesting. I enjoyed it. And the more I thought about it, you know, it went up in my estimation. I feel like there is so much to take in with this movie, and it references so many other movies in interesting ways. Like Rian Johnson, he definitely knows his film history. It's one of those stories that you can just delve into and just explore. And we're only seeing glimpses at this world that he's created, but I feel like there are a lot of just really interesting ideas being thrown around with this movie. So what did you think about it?
I liked it a lot. I was I didn't really know what to expect because I'd heard some people really, really love it. I'd heard some people really, really hate it. I was trying to kind of temper my expectations going into this movie. And the first thing that caught me, as it caught a lot of people, is around, I don't know, a third of the way into this movie, halfway into this movie, where we realize that we've kind of been subject to a bait and switch. The sales pitch that what do you do when you have to kill yourself is not the crux of the story because it's expected. That's the thing. The moment that we understand that they will have to close their loop, you kind of sit there and scratch your head and say, well, wait a second. I thought that was the whole crux of the movie, was here he was being sent back to kill himself, and he doesn't really know how to handle it. Well, that moment where I was like, okay, so that's not what this movie is about. Huh. It gave me a surprise, which I've always said, in an age where we know damn near everything about a movie going into a movie, to surprise the audience, I think, is a very special thing. So when it surprised me and I was basically starting at zero, I was totally on board for this film, and I really, really enjoyed what I saw.
Yeah, it's really off-putting at first because you go in thinking, well, the trailer gives a lot away. Okay, it's going to be a moral dilemma kind of movie. What do you do with yourself, basically? And maybe there's a little of that, but really, I mean, Joseph Joe doesn't really spend that much time worrying about that. He's fine shooting himself. He just wants his life back. But then when it flips, and it almost becomes like a Terminator story, where basically Bruce Willis is coming back to – basically willingly coming back to fix his future. And man, that I can see people not liking it, though, because it can be really, like, if you go in expecting one thing, especially in this day and age, it's pretty rare to come into a movie with everything you know and just be like, I haven't seen any of this. This wasn't in the trailer, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why it took me about a day or so, right? And then I thought, you know, I'm okay with that. This was really, really interesting movie, and even, you know, and creepier than I expected, for sure.
Yeah. You know, the one thing that this movie employs that I'm growing to love more and more and more as time goes on is it paints a future that feels very much like our present. There are little elements here and there that are, like, clearly not of our time, and I'm thinking of stuff like that bike that Paul Dano buys that won't work, and you know, like, of course, like the phones and stuff like that. But he, you know, they dress the way we dress. They're using items that we use. His watch, of course, is a throwback piece, which I'm sure is not an accident. And it's very, very grounded. It reminds me of stories like Minority Report, for instance, which is supposed to take place, like, still a good, like, 30 or 40 years from where we are now, but much of Georgetown in that movie feels like the Georgetown that still exists.
Yeah, and it's an interesting mix because you even look at the cars, and there's some cars that are like today's cars.
Yeah.
That, you know, and you think about it, you think, you know, in the future, especially given the future they present, where some people are not very well off, they would still drive cars like that. You see now people still drive cars from the 60s. So that is something you don't see. They don't over-stylize it and try and make it look like a future where there are flying cars everywhere and things just look ridiculous. In a weird way, it's like I like the way he mixes the digital effects with the practical effects, and it's a world where you think, you know, that, yes, it's a bit of a stretch with the time travel, but it could happen.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, too, because there's a moment where Jeff Daniels, as the slimy boss of the Loopers, he points out how all of the younger agents are so obsessed with the past. Like, he says they, you know, they're dressing like things they see in movies from 30 and 40 years ago. And you really do get that impression with Joe because, you know, he carries that timepiece and he drives an older car. And it's just one of these things to underline a longing for another time, which, of course, is it's his whole story. Gordon-Levitt Joe and Willis Joe, they're always thinking of a different time. And it's a great little way to underscore that with the way he dresses and the items he carries.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a really good point because especially with Bruce Willis's character where he's so focused on this happy time that he had for a few years that he's blind to everything else. And even Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he has this idealized image of this life that he wants to have with this prostitute that could never happen. But he's still kind of looking at it that way. And that's what I think is so good about Rian Johnson with all three of his movies. Like even with Brick, where it's kind of a silly premise, like it's film noir in a high school, but he commits himself to it so much. And here's the same thing. This world, he commits it to it so much where you think, yeah, if you really describe the plot, it's kind of ridiculous. But he commits to it so the world feels believable.
Speaking of that plot, you know, so first of all, we have to understand what it would take to actually course correct our future, whether it means you have to go and prevent something from happening or cause something to happen. And we don't necessarily understand what the side effects could be. It's sort of funny because we've all had that conversation of, you know, geez, if I could just go back and tell myself not to get on that train that day or not to miss that test or not, you know, to do that thing. We don't always understand what preventing that one domino to fall, what else is going to happen, right?
Yeah, and even the sense that would you really be able to convince yourself? Like Bruce Willis is trying to convince his version, trying to convince Joe, the younger Joe, what he needs to do, and the guy just doesn't get it and just wants to shoot him. And it's like, if you went back to yourself, would you be like, if you told yourself, don't do that, would you, a younger you, just say, oh, screw you, I'm going to do it anyway, old man?
Not only that, but, you know, when he tried, like, because older Joe is back here because he's trying to make some sort of a timeline where his wife survives.
Yes.
And he's just saying, he's like, you know, we have to stop this one person because this one person is who kills my wife. And of course, the younger you is never going to want to put in the work. The younger you is just going to want to find the easy way out. And he says, well, just show me her and I'll just steer clear. Right? As if it's going to be that simple to say, well, when I see that person, I'm just going to walk the other way, not realizing that, of course, there's going to be things in there that are going to course correct. It sets down certain rules for how its time travel works and how things happen. And basically, it's whatever happens to the younger self occurs to the older self. So, you know, if you fall down and you slice open your hand, then the older self will get a scar. So seeing how that applies to Paul Dano when they finally catch up with him, that's some trippy shit.
Yeah, that scene is one of those where, yeah, they do that where they, I mean, you don't, once they show that scene where basically, I mean, the guy's arms are falling off, all that stuff, it's like, it's pretty clear up front. You're like, okay, you see the stakes because then, you know, you're looking at what's happening later in the movie going, you know, this, anything happens to one guy, it's interrelated. Like this guy falls out of a window, what has happened to him as an older self or whatever.
But as a one-way street, anything can happen to the older one, but you have to protect the younger one at all costs.
Who cares if we kill the older one? His time has passed. Yeah. I wanted to bring up, though, the sequence that's, to me, is the best sequence in the movie.
Okay.
Which is when after Bruce Willis arrives, and then they cut to basically what happened in Bruce Willis's life. It's almost like it reminds me of like the sequence of the it's done so well for, in a weird way. It reminded me of the beginning of Up, which I know sounds odd, but it goes through basically
in a very reality. Okay, yeah.
It's a stretch, you know. I'm not reaching here, but it's basically the sequence where they go through 30 years of his life very quickly, but it's done so well where you totally get where this guy's coming from. You get why he's a total, you know, badass and can just shoot everybody and be because of it, what you've seen and what it goes through. That sequence to me, I mean, is it's unbelievable how much plot you can convey without with just so few words and images.
What I loved about this movie is when it really throws the glove down and says you're either going to keep up with me or you're going to bail out now is it takes things out of order. We witness the escape. We witness Bruce Willis's escape first, and then it comes back and it shows us the execution and then where younger Joe goes. So I could hear people in my theater were confused. It's like, wait a second, why did he just shoot him twice? And if he got away the first time, how can he kill him the second time? You know, that sort of thing. So I loved that they put them out of order just to basically make sure you were paying attention and see what was going on and to basically set up, you know, you're basically setting up what's happening while Gordon Levitt is knocked out. And what you lead me to and what is very important, certainly what is, I believe, the crux of this movie is how we become what we become. We see this with Joe. And later on, we see this with the child, with Sid. And it's for positive and negative, whether it's a lucky break or somebody wronging us or somebody in our life being there or, conversely, not being there. This movie is very, very interested in what events shape us as human beings.
Exactly, because, I mean, with Sid himself, too, it's like – you look at that kid who can be so sweet and yet so scary, and it boils it down to, okay, if a certain event happens, then – I mean, it doesn't show you the whole thing, but then this will probably happen. And you think of with Joe, it's like Jeff Daniels tells him you should really go to China. And then basically what we see is what would happen if he did that. If he doesn't tell him that – what happens differently? You know, how is he shaped? It's just really interesting how, in a sense, they're basically in this world showing that one little move or big move can change everything.
Well, not only that, but even just the fact that what he has chosen to do with his life, the fact that he is a looper, the point that to end your job, you need to kill your older self. That's going to screw you up. That is going to lead you to 30 very messed up years. I cannot possibly imagine a lot of well-adjusted, happily golden year living loopers out there.
No, and you see that with – I mean, it's kind of tragic when you see the guys celebrating that they've closed their loop. And then you just see, you know, you see what happens with, you know, the drug addiction and everything for Joe. But you're wondering, these other guys probably – it's not – they might not even live that long. I mean, how many don't even make it 30 years. I mean, that's the thing. You kind of have this. That's what I like about the movie is, on a sense, it's a time travel story with, you know, a plot that's very complicated. But there's this sadness to a lot of the movie that I think really sticks with you when it's over. Even though it kind of has, you know, quote unquote, a happy ending, there's so much sadness involved with the whole thing.
Yeah, it's a movie that the more I think back on it, the more I like, which I swear to God, this movie, when I boil it down, it is so friggin' simple, and I don't know why I didn't see the end coming, because I really should have. There's something to be said for that. It's kind of funny, because I know a lot of people, they wanted to see a chase movie, they wanted to see a sci-fi movie. I think there were kind of swaths of something like Blade Runner in the ads for this movie, but I think in the end, when you get this very human story, when you get the interaction with Sarah, played by Emily Blunt, who's not really a love interest, it's just another character who, like Joe at this point, is also very damaged. And certainly with Sid, who's also a kid who's very mixed up at where he's at. You know, he knows that, or at least he's confused of whether his mom is actually his mom. It's these human emotions, it's these human frailties that really solidify Looper as a great story.
Definitely. And I think that's really what sticks with you, because that's it works. If you just think of it as a time travel movie with time loops and some mind-bending stuff, it works in that way. But like you said, I didn't really see like his solution to get out of it. I didn't see that coming. And that reason is because I was wrapped up in the story of the mom and the son and him. And it wasn't just about, oh, how's it going to end? How's Bruce Willis? You know, what's going to happen with that? That almost seems secondary. It was almost like for a little while you forget about Bruce Willis, and it's not his fault. It's just that there's so much more to the story than just, oh, we need to stop this guy from, or possibly he should succeed for the future.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, sounds like we both really dig this movie, which means that we should have lots to choose from when it comes to a souvenir. So if you could keep any one little thing, a moment, a prop, performance, if you could keep one thing as a souvenir from Looper, what would you keep as your souvenir?
Well, I already mentioned what I would have chosen, which is that sequence from all the years. So I'll pick something else.
Okay.
The one that really sticks with me is, for a movie this complicated, to have the scene with when Garrett Dillahunt arrives, when the kid falls down the steps, and that scene is just creepy as hell.
Yeah.
And strangely beautiful, though, at the same time. There's something about that scene that, even though you kind of see it coming, that, wow, that scene, that image of him floating and the whole thing really sticks with me. And that's, in a movie filled with interesting images and scenes, that to me is up there.
That's for sure. Well, for mine, I'm also choosing a scene. It is the diner scene. It is one of the few scenes where Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis are face to face and have a moment to talk. It's a great moment because it underlines the work that everybody involved with the film has done to make them look, well, basically to make Gordon-Levitt look like Bruce Willis. They didn't do a lot of bending the other way, but even in that moment, you kind of see how Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he's taken on a few of Willis's mannerisms. Like, he kind of speaks a few of the words very similar. He's got a few gestures that are very similar, and you're watching them face to face, and it's a great scene of two actors sitting at a table. And it's, as I said, it's a rarity in the film. They don't really get a whole lot of time to actually play off each other, and it's wonderful. Well, we rank on a scale of 1 to 4 stars. So, Dan Heaton, what do you give Rian Johnson's Looper?
It's very close, but because there are a few goofy things in the plot that I didn't love. But I'm going to say 4 out of 4. I love the ambition.
Good for you.
And I just think there's so much going for this movie that the few things where my mind kind of questions it, I can push aside. I think it's one of the top movies of the year.
Very cool. It is a 3.5 for me. I get the feeling that it's one that's going to play up to a 4 when I rewatch it a few times and just kind of fill in some gaps and fill in some questions. I was a little thrown at one moment by the pacing, but not in a very, very bad way. It was just what kind of kept it from being a holy cow movie down into a, wow, that was really good. So 3.5 for me. And as I say, if I watch it just one or two more times, if it's $5, it'll play up into a 4. And that's, that's our scores on Looper. I know some people out there love it. I know some people out there hate it. I would love to talk with people about it. So let me know what you think, either by email, on Twitter, you can leave a comment, Facebook, you name it. Come on right back after this. We are going to have a special edition of The Other Side in honor of Thanksgiving right after this. Well, ordinarily, the films that we choose for The Other Side are reflective of the films that we speak about on the New Slang. So you'll get things like thematic connections or directorial connections or just, connections of all sorts of other types. But for this episode, I put it to Dan to choose a film that underlines something you're thankful for. And I was thankful to what Dan came back with, because he gave me a short list of movies that he said could sum up his ideas. And one of them is a high personal favorite for me. Dan came back with Out of Sight. It's a film from 1998 by Steven Soderbergh. And if you haven't seen it by now, you really should stop listening right this moment and go find yourself a copy. It's it stars Jennifer Lopez and George Clooney, and it's basically a heist film and a very sexy romance all blended into one glorious package. So, Dan, the one thing I will say, actually, that I think is actually a connection between Out of Sight and the film that we just talked about, Looper, is I think Looper is going to fly a little bit under the radar. Like, it made $20 million over the weekend, which is not a great deal of money. Hotel Transylvania made about double that. And of course, you know, summer movies tend to premiere to $50, $60, $70 million. So I get the hunch that Looper is going to be a little bit underexposed. But I also get the feeling that it's a film that a lot of people are going to find kind of like Brick on Blu-ray and on DVD and on demand. And Out of Sight was very much like that. When it came out in 1998, not a lot of people saw it. It really, really flew under the radar in comparison to that. Like, that was a summer movie, and that's the same summer that you had Godzilla and Armageddon and those kinds of great big blockbusters. So this thing really got forgotten.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one of the reasons, too, like you said, is Clooney was known as a TV actor. He'd done a few movies like The Peacemaker and One Fine Day, and he hadn't done that much. And even Soderbergh was known as an indie filmmaker who did Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and then a lot of movies that not many people saw. So it was before the Ocean's movies. So at that point, it was one of those things where all of the actors and people involved were just right before they were going to kind of hit it big. And so, I mean, Looper's, in a sense, I think is that way, too, because I think Rian Johnson is going to be quite a filmmaker, and I think is going to really rise to prominence. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt is on that way, too. So, yeah, I think it's a connection. I mean, I think Out of Sight really slid by people, and there's still people that haven't seen it that I feel like would love it.
Nick Hoth, who emailed earlier on about how she's thankful for going to film class, I'm continually jealous of her, because every week she writes in on the Saturdays when I post what I've been watching, she writes in about the movie she's watching for the first time, and some of these movies that she gets to experience, not, you know, coming into them cold. I think I wish I could go back and watch that again for the first time. Out of Sight is definitely one of those where I wish I could go back. I didn't this is one that I didn't catch in a theater either. I wish I could go back to 98 and have caught a screening of it.
Yeah, I did see it in 98 was the time when I graduated from college in 1998. And that time period, like 97 through 99, when it was really, you know, the indie rise after Pulp Fiction had come, there were so many movies coming out at that point, like from filmmakers like Soderbergh and others. That was a time when I saw so many movies in the theater. So it still seems like a lot of my favorite movies are from that era. And it was the perfect time for me. And you know, but it had been a few years since I'd seen it. So watching it this week, there were things I had forgotten. I'd forgotten how funny it is. I'd forgotten even some of the characters in it. And like Isaiah Washington shows up and even Don Cheadle. And just, you know, it just moves. Like, it has a relaxed – it's interesting for a crime story that involves bank robberies and, you know, shootings and different things, how relaxed it feels. And this is Soderbergh at its best. I mean, just, it's so relaxed, and it just moves so well. It's one of those movies that you can just watch over and over.
Well, now I'm going to put you on the spot, because I actually don't necessarily know why you chose it. Because I just said, give me a film that epitomizes something you're thankful for. So now you need to bring me and all the listeners into the light and tell me why you chose Out of Sight.
Well, one of the reasons is obvious. It's one of my, not my 10 favorites, but one of my 20 favorite, 30 favorite movies. But I'm also a really big Elmore Leonard fan. Like, especially in the 90s, I had a phase in the 90s when I was starting to read more books and more different things and got into a lot of crime novels. And I read a lot of Elmore Leonard books. I mean, some that aren't that great, some that are very good. And I feel like, even though his books seem tailored for movies, there are very few. I can count four examples of where they really got him.
It sounds like you're thankful for the marriage of great source material with great execution.
Exactly, yeah. And especially in the fact that George Clooney, I mean, you know, at the time, you did not know that George Clooney could go on to play Danny Ocean and play these other characters. And Jennifer Lopez, too, who's barely ever good in movies. I think mainly because she takes bad movies. But to find all these people working at the top of their game, it's one of those movies that just surprises me every time I see it. And I'm thankful that there are movies like this that you can get kind of hardened as a film lover sometimes, even about classics, but this movie never comes into play.
It's one of those movies I've kind of got about, I don't know, 20 or 30 of movies like this that I could recite. I've seen them so often I could probably quote you any line in the movie. And I almost call them reset movies. Like, if I've been watching a great deal of new material, or if I've been watching a great deal of heavier stuff, whether I've seen it before or not, these are good ones to throw on and basically, like, cleanse the palate and just hit your reset button and just get into a comfort zone. It's kind of funny too, because the night before you emailed me saying, all right, Out of Sight is one of the movies I'd like to talk about, I had watched Get Shorty on the heels
oh, wow.
of having well on the heels of having watched Touch of Evil. I was like, well, I finished watching Touch of Evil. I was like, well, I gotta watch Get Shorty now, because there's that Touch of Evil scene in Get Shorty. And when you said Out of Sight, I'm like, I watched that for this show. I thought to myself, well, might as well finish the trilogy. So even just tonight, I just finished watching Jackie Brown. So I went on the Elmore Leonard trilogy the last few days, mostly on your suggestion. And it's been just great revisiting these films that, especially in the case of Get Shorty and Jackie Brown, had been far too long since I watched.
Yeah, I picked up Jackie Brown when it came out on Blu-ray recently. I'm in the minority, but it's hard to say best, but it is my favorite Tarantino movie. Ooh. And I think part of that is because of my connection, because I like Elmore Leonard so much.
That's heresy around some parts.
I've gotten some flack for it, and I like Tarantino.
Well, do you have a takeaway? Like, if somebody hasn't seen Out of Sight, the one thing you'd say, kind of watch it and watch it for this and keep this in mind, that kind of thing?
Just how you can do a really subtle, effective romance, too.
Yep.
That's the takeaway, because I feel like I've been talking a lot about crime and Elmore Leonard, but the romance in this movie, just a glance, there's a scene where basically Clooney just waves to Jennifer Lopez, and it's perfect. And that does so much more than people that talk for 10 minutes. It's perfect.
Yeah, I hear you. The scene, of course, that always jumps to mind for me, or one of them, I should say, because Lord knows this movie is chocked full of them. But the seduction scene in the bar, people will be hard-pressed, I would say, to find a sexier or a more romantic scene, and it is really it certainly cuts to a love scene, but it is in no way explicit. It is all a seduction that just happens in how they talk to one another, and it's awesome. There's traces of an older movie called Don't Look Now that are in this scene as well, and it's one of the best scenes that Soderbergh has ever done. So yeah, if people haven't seen it, yeah, definitely watch it. If you're a guy, if you're a girl, trust me, this is one sexy movie. No matter what your preference is, there will be something in this movie for you. So that is definitely a takeaway. Well, I've got one movie that I'm thankful and for, and I'll talk about it in just a moment. So come on right back after this. For my movie that I epitomizes something that I'm thankful for, it could not have less in common with either Looper or Out of Sight. It is from 1979. It is a movie that I only watched for the first time last year and has now gone on to become one of my favorites. It's from 1979. It is Woody Allen's Manhattan. And if you listened to my podcast series with Simon Collum, The Film Locker, where we talked about Woody Allen, I do apologize because I am going to repeat a few things. One of the things that I love about Manhattan is it epitomizes life in a big city. And it starts that with one of the most beautiful and wonderful openings of a film, montage or no, that you will ever see. It's this great just look at New York City circa 1979 in glorious black and white, and it's Woody Allen narrating over Rhapsody in Blue, which, you know, I can't really think of many more New York things than Woody Allen, black and white, and Rhapsody in Blue. What I love about it, when I say that it's life in a big city, there's people everywhere, and there's conversations about neuroses and self-consciousness and betrayal and that kind of thing, and they're happening these very private moments happening in very public places. They're happening on in cafes, and they're happening in like on busy city streets, and they're happening on subways and that kind of thing. Larger cities in the world, places like Chicago, New York, Paris, London, Tokyo, certain parts of Toronto, that's what happens. You will be talking about something that you would normally only talk to one person sitting in a bar or sitting in a lunchroom or just sitting on your couch, and you're surrounded by complete strangers. It very much epitomizes that kind of life. And I think Woody Allen recognizes that. He spends much of that opening montage trying to get things just right about this New York story. And as the film plays out, I actually think he gets things right about this New York story.
And it's interesting to me that you brought up, I hadn't really considered too much that part of it, the fact that they're having such private moments in public places. But yeah, I think that's another good point about basically what he's trying to show about a really big city. The way that he shoots New York City, I mean, the movie itself, there's various romances and things involved with several different characters, Woody Allen and several others. But it's really, I mean, this is obvious, but it's a love letter to New York City. And it's just, the way he shoots it is just with so much warmth that I've seen plenty of his movies. You see a little bit of Midnight in Paris and some of his other movies, but I don't think any of his movies he shoots with the same level of just kind of romance for the location.
It's, well, because it's his home, right? Like, it was the thing I noticed when I watched Midnight in Paris is he kind of echoes that opening montage again, but in Midnight in Paris, it's the montage of a visitor. It's the montage of a tourist, certainly echoing, you know, the main character Gil's nostalgia for a city like Paris. Manhattan, it's more of a New Yorker's look of Manhattan. There are, of course, the typical trademark spots. Like, he's got things like he's got Central Park all over the place. He's got Yankee Stadium, but he's also got things like he's got the crowded phone banks, and he's got the taxis going left and right, and that kind of thing, and then the trains, and the Staten Island Ferry. He's got things that would have a little bit more romance if you're there. So
yeah,
you know, that's the thing. He is very New York, and even though he's been trying to branch out and he's been on this kind of European road trip for a few years, it's something that will always be a part of him.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, you think about just what you identify with Woody Allen beyond the neurotic behavior and just kind of his comedy. It's New York City. You can't separate the two. It's like looking at Michael Mann and talking about Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just certain directors that are tied in to certain cities. The things you bring up about the city and about the way, just like the scenes in the planetarium and the scenes with them sitting, him and Diane Keaton's character sitting on the bench, are just gorgeous and fit so well with just the way he's looking at the city.
Another reason why I chose it, and it didn't really dawn on me until I rewatched it for this episode, is I believe that it's an example of really, really good romantic comedy. I think romantic comedy gets a bad rap. I think people now have equated romantic comedy with the latest piece of Katherine Heigl tripe, and I don't think that's fair, because I think there's a craft to creating great romantic comedy. It's something that, like, somebody like Nora Ephron was able to do really, really well. And you know, Woody Allen really plays with that in this film. There's even a moment, like, I'm not really spoiling much, but the film in its later moments involves Woody Allen running down the streets of Manhattan, like we see in so many romantic comedies, where in the last moment a character realizes something fantastic and needs to run to take care of it right away. Woody Allen being Woody Allen, he gets winded. His run turns into a saunter, which turns into a walk with him holding his side because he has a stitch. And it's that kind of wittiness and self-awareness that I think is really, really what makes this film clever, along with a lot of the one-liners that he gets off. Of course, it also, another thing that I brought it up for, in terms of why I'm thankful, is it again, in its later moments, he actually takes a moment and he talks about the things that make life worth living. And he lists off things like Cezanne paintings and Willie Mays and Bergman films. And I think we've all done that at one point or another in life. We've created a blog list, or we might have written it down in a journal or something like that about the great things in life. And if we haven't, then, you know, I would put it to you, if you haven't done such a thing, maybe you should, because you kind of take stock of these things that you take for granted.
Being, you know, the age that I am, I mean, you know, 36, you definitely have these points, especially when you start writing more with the blog, where you start thinking, you know, okay, what, you know, what really are the great things? Or what, you know, you start thinking big picture kind of stuff. And that's where you don't – Woody Allen does that a lot. But I don't know if he always gets that much credit for it, because, you know, you think of it as, oh, the zany comedies, and, oh, he's dating a younger woman, which he is in this movie for sure. But he is very introspective, especially with some of the other movies you think of, like something like, you know, Stardust Memories or something, where he's so introspective in what he's doing. And this movie especially, I mean, it's all about him and what he's going through at the time. And that's how the characters are basically written, at least to me. It feels – I don't – know what he was thinking at the time, but that sure seems like that feels that way to me.
Yeah, that's, you know, if there's a knock on the film for me, that's kind of the knock, is that the three women, Diane Keaton, Mariel Hemingway, and Meryl Streep, they're a little incidental. It really is Isaac's story, and you know, while Tracy, the Mariel Hemingway character, is what, you know, gives him his spark, she's still playing second fiddle, unfortunately. So that is kind of where Woody sort of missed the step.
There's still so much to like about the movie. There's moments I had totally forgotten, just like him walking into that conversation with the pretentious film director and all that stuff. I mean, there are just really funny moments where he's just taking his shots at basically pretentious art people.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, and I do love those. Now, there was one underlying reason, though, why I chose this as a film to epitomize something I'm thankful for. And that is because back in July, I took a little road trip down to Chicago, and I got together with a bunch of people who I'd only known as voices on podcasts and avatars in my comment section, and people like Kristen Griffin, who was on the Born Legacy episode of the Matinee Cast, and Sam Fragoso, and Fredo from Film Yarn. And Sam and Fredo actually got into a teasing little argument, because Sam is a big, big fan of Woody Allen. And, I could be putting words in Sam's mouth, but kind of considers him the be-all and end-all at the moment. Fredo, to tease him, said, oh, that's very – what I believe his words were – first year film school or second year film school.
Oh, where, ouch.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Sam isn't even in film school yet, right? Sam's only
17. Yeah, he's 18. Young.
Yeah, so it was, first of all, to witness this kind of conversation and, you know, Fredo going back and forth about how Woody Allen may or may not be everything he's made out to be, and Sam arguing vehemently, these guys never having met before, and all of it happening and making me very, very homesick for my friends back here in Toronto who have these kinds of conversations all the time. It made me very, very thankful that, one, that I am part not only of a large community of friends here in my home city, but just that it goes worldwide. The people that I met in Chicago, the people who came up for TIFF, they all felt like people who I'd known for a very, very long time. And in many ways, you know, the kinds of people who write the sites like Dan, that you and I do, and then the people that we know do, and who host these podcasts and listen to these podcasts, we're all very, very similar. And I was very thankful to learn that, to have some wonderful moments this year with people who, as I said, previously might as well have been strangers, but we're all kind of united by this common love for a silly little thing when you think about what movies really are. And it made me very, very thankful. And Manhattan, Woody Allen, that argument between Sam Fragoso and Fredo from Film Yarn really, really kind of summed up something I was really happy to be part of.
No, I'll agree with you. I mean, on that, just in general, because I started my blog. I've been writing about films for years. I started my blog about a year and a half ago, and kind of thinking I'd write it. Maybe some friends and family would read it, and did not have any idea of all the film community and bloggers that are out there. And that's been the really big surprise, more than the movies I've seen since then. It's just been all the interactions with cool people like Sam and Fredo and yourself and so many others. I mean, it's been a real surprise and been one, you know, wonderful. And I'm really thankful for that too.
Definitely. Well, I must apologize actually, because I did forget how reasonably close St. Louis is to Chicago. And after the fact, I was like, you know, I should have invited Dan to this thing. I don't know why I didn't. But
it's okay. You know, I'll get there soon.
That is episode 69 of the Matinee Cast, and I am thankful that you have listened this far and that you continue to listen. Come on back on Monday, October 22nd for episode 70. That's where we'll discuss Seven Psychopaths. Dan writes at ptsnob.com. Do you have anything coming up next week that you want to plug?
Well, a lot of what I do on my blog is I kind of organize my stuff into marathons, and I'm actually starting a new one pretty much around when this airs, which is looking at some famous flops.
Nice.
So I'm actually going to watch John Carter, and that's going to go up on the 8th, and then I'm going to watch Battlefield Earth and Howard the Duck and a few others, which I have not seen any of these before.
I like John Carter, actually.
I kind of like John Carter, too. It was kind of a surprise.
Are you going to watch Ishtar?
I don't know. I mean, I only want to watch usually four or five because I try and mix it up.
But watch Ishtar.
I'm trying to figure out what films four and five will be.
I see. Well, and if people want to find you on Twitter, where do they find you?
Oh, at PTSnob, so it's pretty easy.
Very nice. My site is thematinee.ca. For more podcasting content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Listen, Blueberry, the iTunes Music Store, or the iPhone podcasting app. They'll give you ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes are released. Feedback on Looper, on movies that scared you, Out of Sight, or Manhattan can be left in the comment section of the site. You can email me, ryan@thematinee.ca. You can find me on Twitter, where I'm matinee_ca, or Facebook.com/darkmatinee. Mr. Heaton, do you have any final thoughts before we close this down for the night?
Nope, it was a great time. I'm glad to see Looper and talk about some other great past movies. It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
By now, I'll probably be on my second plate of turkey and mashed potatoes, so please pray for me to get on the treadmill this week. But for Dan, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee.
If the sun refused to shine, I would still be loving you. Mountains crumble to the sea, there will still be you and me.